dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
as we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. As today is America's annual celebration of the Declaration of Independence, which is marked as the birth of the nation, tonight's program will feature two serious but fun talks about America past and present, its leaders and its wars, its calls to patriotism, and its true state religion, the creed of the free market, and some of the realities of how that creed is practiced today. In our first hour, we'll hear from American historian and novelist Gore Vidal, with a talk he originally gave last Memorial Day. Since most of our holidays and patriotic songs seem to have to do with war, this talk seemed appropriate for this holiday as well. And in our second hour, we're going to hear from Eric Schlosser, who you may recognize as the author of Fast Food Nation. He has a new book, Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. And that will be his topic tonight. From east to the west, to hold you alive in this darkness and midnight. It seemed fitting to begin with a reading from that document, written by armed revolutionaries, resolved to free themselves by any means necessary from the rule of their quote-unquote lawful government. All governments always consider themselves lawful governments, as you may have noticed. The 18th-century terrorist Thomas Jefferson wrote, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government, and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain, George III, is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states, To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world.
I didn't know his name. 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 Another man done gone.
This is Gore Vidal in the Hollywood Hills. And I don't think anyone looks forward to Memorial Day because of all the sadness that accrues to it over the years and after so many American wars.
Killed another man.
Fought in the past,
they
in the present, presumably at the rate we're going, in the future too.
Another man done gone.
Some wars more necessary than others, some not at all. But as Memorial Day approaches, we keep hearing a lot on television about the greatest generation, which was Second World War, in which 16 million of us were engaged in both the Pacific and the Atlantic theaters of operation. I was in the Pacific side and did nothing brave or interesting, but survived it. Now, there's a bit of tension building up because of the war in Iraq, which was mysteriously brought into our lives by a president who believed in a new doctrine called preemptive war. You decide that somebody might one day be an enemy, harbor terrorists. So you were honor-bound in the name of the Republic to strike them, destroy them. And that's where we are today. So not to continue in this depressing vein, let's cheer ourselves up. I've got some tapes here that will remind you of who we were and of who we are, I like to think. First, I want to start with the famous battle hymn of the Republic, which began as an old drinking song in England. Then the music was taken over for a kind of hymn to John Brown of Kansas, who single-handedly decided that he was going to free the slaves and was taken captive, executed after his raid on Harper's Ferry. A poet, Julia Ward Howe, thought it was not quite noble enough for a noble cause like the Civil War, which was just beginning. And so she changed the lyrics. And she was no longer John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. But Julia Ward Howe raised the ante, and she made it a battle for God and the good and the great, and, as Abraham Lincoln would say, the better angels of our nature. And then from that I'd like to go back to a voice that I think we all need to hear.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in his grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in his grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in his grave. But his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. A soldier in the army of the Lord. He is gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. His soul is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on.
That was the background music to a whole generation to which I belong. And in a sense, it was a dedication to the elimination of fascism around the world, of Hitler, and hopes for a new and better world. Everybody has those hopes all the time, particularly people who start wars. But we had a leader then, and would that we had him now. And I think it's a good tonic for all of us on this Sunday to hear the voice of Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivering his inaugural address, long awaited, to the people of this nation and to the people hostile to us, hostile to freedom. And here he is, our great president.
This is a day of national consecration. And I am certain that on this day, my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured. We will survive and we will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
This speech was something of a tonic to the American people who had undergone a number of years of depression, the Dust Bowl. Just about everything that could go wrong domestically had gone wrong. And yet this was a voice of hope. And listening to it after such a long time, I'm struck by two things. One, by Julia Ward Howe's lyrics, and something President Roosevelt said, and it's as if they were working together. Of course, they could never have met, but anyway, one plays off the other. Her lyric is, "His truth shall go marching on." Interesting, the word truth. And then Roosevelt, in his speech, starts to talk about what a president should do, which is to tell the truth, no matter how bad as he sees it. You heard the line, truth. Both the lady poet back in the Civil War and the president at the heart of the Depression, with war clouds gathering, speaks of the necessity to tell the truth to the people about their situation, about their condition. I hadn't realized till I just heard it how apt both these texts are for today, when truth is not something that we hear very often in what we call our media, but is something that we all crave and hunger for. And it is a sign of a great statesman that he knows instinctively and instinctively says the thing the people most need to hear. And then, of course, another thing which brings us to today, ignoble today, that the necessity for a government to be responsible, to tell the people the truth about their situation. I remember the day that Singapore fell. I was at school in New England, and the headmaster quoted the president who had been speaking the night before. And Roosevelt said, "Tonight, the news is all bad." Can you imagine a president today, even a good one, making such a confession? The war was going against us. badly going against us. We were the side of virtue, too, that time. And we were losing. The Japanese were seizing cities that had belonged to the colonial powers like England. And I thought to myself, would anyone speak such truth to us again? Or is it too late to tell us the truth because we're so used to lie upon lie upon lie? Anyway, these are thoughts that come to my mind at the time of that we are encouraged to remember those who fought in the other wars and those who are placed in this war in the Middle East, a war which was not declared by Congress as Article 1 of the Constitution requires. It was just hurried through by a little fellow. He said, I'm a wartime president. So there. And I'm going to attack preemptive because they may have one day weapons of mass destruction and they may use them. And again, they may not. But I'm going to hit them because I want a war. He did not speak that much truth, but that was the gist of what he had said. I guess Memorial Day is as good a day to recollect how far we have come from we have nothing to fear but fear itself. We've got a government that stays in power and increases power by frightening the American people to death. We may be struck again. Maybe by next Tuesday, I remember hearing that right after 9/11. Maybe next Tuesday. They were desperate to terrify the American people, to keep them in a state absolutely congealed with terror, so that they could begin their work of wartime powers, which means you can dismantle the Bill of Rights, you can arrest anybody you feel like it. If the Attorney General or the President says, oh, he's a terrorist, I can tell by the look in his eye, let's hold him. And so we have held tens of thousands of people, first in Guantanamo, mostly innocent people, it appears, certainly people from whom we got no information of any value, and the late ongoing scandals of the prisons in Iraq, which has made us, you know, the most hated nation on earth. And yet you just heard the voice of our greatest president talking about telling the truth. No matter if you have to admit that we have lost a battle, we have lost a great city of Hong Kong, of Singapore, we're losing the war in the Pacific. And he tells us, and that renews our vigor to fight in that war. I enlisted in that army, and I certainly was no war lover and no idealistic, thinking the world would be wonderful again, but we all did, most of us did, without question. Now there is already talk, I hope it is just talk, that the draft may be brought back, since people do not seem to be signing up for a war in which the leaders of it, whether it is the president himself, Rumsfeld, and all of the grisly crew at the Pentagon keep lying about. So, Memorial Day. Remember what we were. Remember that we had somebody called Franklin Roosevelt. Remember that he gave us the world. Literally. And remember that when he saw that what terrible domestic shape we were in due to depression, due to a mismanaged economy, due to who knows the position of the moon. Nobody ever knows for certain why things go wrong. But he knew the first thing you do is you don't declare yellow alert, orange alert, purple alert. You have nothing to fear but fear itself. Pull up your socks, stop it. And let them fear us. And let us go about our work unterrified by vague threats of botulism in the reservoir. Yes, terrible things could happen to us, and the more that we provoke other people, the more we treat them like animals, the more quickly they will organize, and they will come, and they will kill us. That's the first law of physics. There is no action without reaction. And we're about to see a lot of reaction. And there is nothing much that we can do about it, as we have put our foot in it, as they say, far too deeply to extricate ourselves without a drastic change in our political arrangements. Once you get into the habit of lying, whether you're a general or a president or a newspaper or a talking head on television, it's very hard to break the habit. We have made it pretty clear, our government, that the troops would be rotated, the ones in Iraq. They're not being rotated. And everything is done that is possible to shut them up. But they are complaining. For those who would like to see some of their complaints, I suggest they read the Army Times, which is a newspaper put out by the men in the Army. They feel not only lied to, but cheated. Just now, I suppose, to celebrate Memorial Day, we're told that 44,000 troops that were due to go home, due to be rotated, are to be kept on as policemen, or whatever word we want to use for the purposes that we are putting these people to, these American soldiers to. Not to mention the group that I don't understand, the outsourcing of the army to a bunch of people who seem to be rejects from the American prison system. And as many people have pointed out, as awful as what we were doing, many of these people too, who are not soldiers but civilians, are doing to the Iraqis in the prisons is no more than what they do on a regular basis, day by day, in the United States, in federal prisons, state prisons, municipal prisons, reform schools. We have more people in prison than any first world country, in any country in history, per capita. And we're going to have many more, because we feel safer that way. And you get rid of voices of dissent. And you get rid of minorities whom you don't like, who might vote against you if they had a chance, as in the state of Florida, when in the year 2000, thousands were declared felons and therefore unable to vote, even though it could not be even established that any of them had committed a felony. But it was a series of lies that worked for the moment, and that is the kind of government that we have got. Now, I will now argue the other side. Those who basically like the war and are quite adjusted to it, presumably don't know much about it, but one of them has said this publicly, and I quote him, "As far as constitutional issues go," and he's answering what I'd said about only Congress can declare war, because the Founding Fathers never, the last thing they wanted was for an American president to declare war or fight a war all on his own. He has too much power to begin with. As commander-in-chief, they were terrified that we would have a tyranny in no time at all. So they carefully wrote that only Congress, and particularly the House of Representatives, as they are the most democratic house we have, since they must stand for election and re-election every 2 years. They are the closest to the people. The president, after 4 years, 8 years, may think of himself as Caesar. But the members of the House know that their togas hang on rather weak pegs. But he said, as far as constitutional issues go, I'm not unconcerned. It's good of him. But I don't see any violations with respect to the Iraq war. Congress gave the president the authority to go to war with Iraq, and Bush used that authority. Well, Congress did not give it to him. Congress went through one of its partisan leaping through hoops. I'm really reading this because somebody said this is the way a lot of Americans think who've bought into the war. And I'm trying to remind them that you don't understand the Constitution or the kind of country we have. And Franklin Roosevelt would be appalled at this absolute perversion of our Constitution and of our duties as citizens. However, what Roosevelt would not have understood is that a gang had seized power, a gang of oil and gas men, and a gang of great corporations who pay for the presidents and are now paying for the House of Representatives and the Senate, at least at that time, a majority. This doesn't happen very often, that you have a president and two houses of Congress, not to mention a supine Supreme Court, all ready to do your bidding. If that is not a cocktail ready for dictatorship, I don't know what is. And we are living in that dictatorship right now, as those who had the good luck to listen to Attorney General Ashcroft and the head of the FBI the other night talking happily about their powers, and we may be struck within the next day or two. Fear, fear. Of course you have nothing to fear but fear itself out there, and we're going to see to it there's a lot more fear coming your way. When it comes to international agreements, I'm back to this guy again, you're right that I'm not particularly concerned with them. Well, isn't that good news? The United States, with what is it? We've got 5% of the world's population, and we are dictating to everybody. So when it comes to international agreements, you're right that I'm not particularly concerned with them. Who on earth does this man think he is? But he is supposed to represent a great deal of American thinking, in which case we have had, it's pretty clear, no public educational system for really since the early 1950s. So here's a man who knows no geography and no history, particularly American history. He doesn't know who we are, what we were, why we started the country in the first place. He thinks might makes right. He's got a nasty surprise coming. This thinking, based upon, one could say, megalomania, certainly based upon a total misunderstanding of the decent opinion of mankind, as Thomas Jefferson referred to one of the things that we should always pay attention to. Because if we are not held responsible, that if we in any way, through torture, murders, violate the decent opinion of mankind, we have had it. It's hard to make people believe, since what passes for a media in this country is nothing but laughing gas. We're number one. Everybody adores us. Look at all the people trying to cross our borders and become Americans. Well, I haven't seen a Norwegian with a green card in a long time. Yes, countries that we have wrecked in Southeast Asia send their excess population over here and hope that they can find homes. From south of the border, we have a constant influx of people. And now, due to some unwise trade agreements like NAFTA, we are getting great exchanges of American jobs going south of the border. The world is shifting against us. And I don't know if today, even if we had a first-rate president, which we don't, even if we had an intelligent president, which we don't, I don't think that if he were eloquent, I don't think he could say to the world with a straight face what Franklin Roosevelt said to the nation before he ran for office a third time, I cannot imagine on the lips of he whom I like to refer to as the Yellow Rose of Texas.
I cannot with candor tell you that all is well with the world. Clouds of suspicion, tides of ill will and intolerance gather darkly in many places. In our own land, we enjoy indeed a fullness of life that is greater than that of most nations. But the rush of modern civilization itself has raised for us new difficulties, new problems, which must be solved if we are to preserve to the United States the political and the economic freedom for which Washington and Jefferson planned and fought.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
In effect, Roosevelt became president for life. He was elected a third time, and then, although he was dying, he was elected a fourth time. He went to Yalta, did his best to make peace with the other colossus of the North, Stalin. Roosevelt did not live to serve his fourth term. But he had changed the United States and the entire world forever. Because of him, we got the United Nations, which some think is a bad thing. In many ways, it has been a useless thing, but it's because we haven't used it properly. We have done our best to sabotage it. So you cannot blame it for a member who is often the worst enemy of this assemblage. More important, he saw that the world was one place, and he wanted to declare for everyone certain rights, certain freedoms, which the so-called Atlantic Covenant, which he and Churchill came up with just before the United States entered the war. And he died on a note of optimism, personally and nationally. And by 1950, he died in 45, in the spring, right after he came back from Yalta. And the whole world went into mourning. I think they suspected what would be next and what was next, thanks to much of corporate America, who saw a great profit to be made out of wars and out of being continually armed with a continuous enemy, in this case, communism and the Soviet Union, neither of which was, despite what we had to read and listen to, was at all dangerous to us. We had atomic weapons. We had the most powerful military in the world. We had the atom bomb. We had a dazzling world economy. The other economies of Europe and Asia were broken. When it came to move artillery out of Central Europe, Stalin had to use horses. No, he was not a nice man. I know we're always looking for a nice man. We never seem to get one if he's a foreigner. Sometimes, however, domestically, we do get one. And you can count on it, particularly if he is known for telling the truth, that he will be deeply hated and thought not to be a nice man. Roosevelt's detractors were the most extraordinary set of people. One line they had against him, he was a traitor to his class, because he was upper class, and he'd been in favor of such communist activities as Social Security. In 1935, Roosevelt put that in, and before that, you went to the poorhouse. If you got old and didn't inherit a lot of money, you looked after yourself. The second great gift that he gave us, again denounced as communism, was the GI Bill of Rights. And he knew that after the Civil War, also after the First World War, and the word hobos became well known because a lot of American boys had no money, had no jobs, and were living on the rails of the different railroads around the country, he thought, this time we will see to it that every American who has served in this war can have a college education. And he was hated for that. People couldn't say, well, we don't want the lower classes to change their station and try to become like us. They didn't dare say that openly, but that's what they meant. They wanted the gardener's son to be a gardener so that they could have another gardener for half as much as they paid his father. This, I think, we would call, you know, pure capitalism. Well, he gave us the impure sort, and he kept us from revolution, which we might well have had, had the returning soldiers, armed to the teeth, remember, there's 16 million of us, if they came back armed and not really having learned much of anything except how to kill, we could have had real trouble on our hands because we had come close to revolution during the Depression, which he staved off with his various WPA and CCC. And he was called a traitor to his class. Well, he'd saved his class. Sometimes one wishes that he'd gone perhaps too far. I have never met my cousin Albert Gore. I knew his father, Senator Gore of Tennessee, before him. I know his daughter, Karenna, a very nice woman, who lives in New York. I never liked his politics because he was a typical Southern Pentagon man. He never voted against the Pentagon budget. Yet our families were not only fairly closely related in blood, but we knew each other. His father looked exactly like my grandfather, who was Senator Thomas Pryor Gore from Mississippi, but Senator from Oklahoma. Albert Gore Sr. was Senator from Tennessee, as was indeed his son. We both went to the same school, St. Albans, at very different times. I had a political career in mind once, but in 1948 I wrote The City and the Pillar, which meant I could have no proper career. That was the end of that. And then I watched him, and I thought, oh, dear. And then I watched him in 2000, and he couldn't make a speech. I thought, after all these years in public life, what's wrong with you? I asked his daughter, Karenna, about it, and she said, well, she didn't concede that, but she did say, well, he's an introvert in an extrovert business. I said, well, leave it to us extroverts, you know. But when I heard him speak, the hysteria on Fox News, oh, he was just like Howard Dean. Oh, yes, he is, said that awful little bow tie boy, just like him. And I listened to these fools. I thought, wow, this was a good speech. He ripped into not only the Pentagon set, but into the dishonorable president and vice president that we have. Dishonorable. And God knows impeachable. I'd explain in my new book, if I may condescend to sell things on radio, Imperial America, I go into about 20 points in which Bush could be easily, under the Constitution, impeached if we had a Congress of any courage. To my surprise, I turn on C-SPAN. I had known that Albert had made a speech and had been well regarded at NYU, wherever it was. And I listened to him and I thought, my God, Albert is a Gore. I'm a Gore, and I've been a Gore a lot longer than he, and we are not like other people. We are generally pretty funny. We generally speak what we mean, and if we don't, we're pretty good actors. And I suddenly saw a Gore up there. It could have been my grandfather. It could have been Albert's father. Could have been me on a good day. And I thought, my God, if we could harness this guy. He went right down the line. It was like a district attorney accusing a gang of various crimes and naming the crimes and mentioning payment for those crimes and what it ought to be. The whole country was heartened by it. I mean, the emails that came in. And I thought, oh my God, if he'd only been nominated this time.
Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. For the old man is coming just to carry the freedom. Follow the drinking gourd. When the sun comes back and the first quail calls, follow the drinking gourd. For the old man is waiting just to carry you to freedom. Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd.
Follow. It has been proposed that I read something from my new book, Imperial America. So I shall read something from it, which I think will be of general interest to us all, because it involves exactly how the next election could be stolen from us by those who do not wish the Republic well. Something to think about as we approach the crucial November 2004 election. In October 2002, Bush signed the Help America Vote Act, known as HAVA, providing $3.9 billion to replace the nation's old worn-out punch card and lever machines with their high error rate. Replacing with what? The three interested companies were ready with direct recording electronic systems like the touch screen. There was only one flaw. DREs, as they are known, are less accurate than punch cards. Worse, interested parties can program them to overturn the actual vote. Lobbyists for direct recording electronic systems got to many of the state officials around the country. Currently, 40,000 Diebold, that's one of the companies, machines, are being used in 37 states. An excellent journalist called Bev Harris, in a book called Black Box Voting, gives most of the details on how this caper began and how it is developing, and it is developing. Some tales of what seems to have been done. In Georgia, a year ago, November, the war hero and Democratic Senator Max Cleland was ahead of his Republican rival, Saxby Chambliss, by 2 to 5 points. The final touchscreen vote gave Chambliss 53 points to Cleland's 46, while Democratic Governor Barnes lost to the Republican candidate Perdue, 46% to 51%, a sudden swing of 9 to 12 points. Also, surreal numbers were coming in from around the state. Solid Democratic districts were going Republican and vice versa. Oh, brave new world. On a lesser scale, odd things were happening in Colorado, Minnesota, Illinois, and New Hampshire. The best account of that ominous election is by Andrew Gumbel in England's newspaper, The Independent. The American press has generally shied away from telling us about ballot fraud. Almost the first hard news of our electoral misadventures was published in New Zealand. Incidentally, the owners of the three computer companies in question all proved to be Republican, while Diebold's chief executive, Walden O'Dell, wrote a fundraising letter for Republicans declaring that he was committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year. Could this explain W's mysterious, if only occasional today, happy face? In recent months, warnings have been appearing, though not very publicly, but they have been appearing in the New York Times and other papers. How are the states responding? Many of these machines have already been bought at tremendous cost. California's authorities seem aware of the dangers. They have mandated a paper trail as proof to the voter and to the ballot counters that each touchscreen vote was actually registered and totaled properly. Unhappily, this safeguard will not go into effect until July of 2005, long after the damage, if there should be any, is done. Thus far, the Federal Voting Assistance Program, under Rumsfeld's Pentagon, has signed up Arkansas, Florida, Hawaii, Utah, Washington, North and South Carolina, and 100,000 voters are expected to use the paperless, hence untraceable, system this very year. A system described by Fortune magazine as, quote, the worst technology of 2003, end quote. During Franklin Roosevelt's first successful campaign for the New York State Senate, his wife Eleanor liked to tell this story on herself. After a hard day of canvassing for the Democrats, she hurried home to Hyde Park. Franklin, there are people buying votes right here in Dutchess County. I have seen them. Don't worry, dear, was the happy warrior's response. The Republicans are buying them too. Let us look to our balloting machines, because they may determine who is the next president. And once again, it will be a man for whom the president, and once again, it will be a man for whom the people, as in the year 2000, did not vote.
Oh, there was an old soldier and he had a wooden leg. Had no tobacco, but tobacco he could beg. Another old soldier, sly as a fox.
He always had tobacco in his old tobacco box.
Said one old soldier, will you give me a chew? Said the other old soldier, I'll be hanged if I do. Save up your pennies and put away your rocks.
And you'll always have tobacco in your old tobacco box.
Oh, we had an old chicken and it wouldn't lay an egg. So I poured hot water up and down its leg. The little chickie cried and the little chickie begged. And
the goddamn chicken laid a hard-boiled egg.
Oh, one old hen, she had a wooden foot. She made her nest by a mulberry bush, but she laid more eggs than any hen on the farm.
And another wooden foot wouldn't do her any harm.
Oh, there was an old soldier and he had a wooden leg. Had no tobacco, but tobacco he could beg. Another old soldier, sly as a fox.
And he always had tobacco in his old tobacco box.
So, on this Memorial Day, I hope I have not bored you with these old speeches and songs, or saddened you with reminders of our one-time greatness in the world. And one only hopes that when, if ever, the current administration allows the troops to come home instead of keeping them there and keeping them there as guardians of public order, keepers of prisons. I trust not training them as torturers, but perhaps allowing this sort of thing to go wrong within the prisons. Atrocities certainly happened in World War II, but nobody was proud of it. And I must say, no general officer ever condoned torture in the prisons or the murder of Japanese soldiers that we had caught, just as they were murdering Americans when they caught them. Wars are bloody, but they need not be as deliberately, as cold-bloodedly murderous as this gang in charge of the Pentagon has allowed. And perhaps, if we ever get an investigation, encouraged. So, one day this too will end. I hope we don't end with it. The troops will come home. And we won't give them a GI Bill of Rights. There's no money left. There's no money for anything. But let us go back to another old song as we think of the happy day when our soldiers who are in the Middle East with no particular plan that we can ascertain on the part of the administration. Here is the song that Abraham Lincoln's Union troops sang mournfully when they weren't coming home, and joyously when they were coming home, having won a great victory, not only for their side, but for the Union itself, which Lincoln himself, almost single-handedly, had held together. Let us hope that there will be another song to celebrate the end of hostilities in a place where we don't belong, and that is not worth the life of one American. Thank you.
You've been listening to Gore Vidal's Reflections on Memorial Day 2004 for Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. This program is directed and engineered in Los Angeles by David Adelson for the LA Sound Posse and engineered and edited by Christopher Zagouras in New York. David Dozer is on the board. Thanks to Great Speeches of the 20th Century and the Pacifica Archives for FDR's two inaugural addresses. The Battle Hymn of the Republic and When Johnny Comes Marching Home come from American Songs of Revolutionary Times and the Civil War Era. Richie Havens sang Follow the Drinking Gourd. The Cumberland Three sang Tobacco Box. You are listening to Franklin Blues, played by Perry Letterman on This World Is Not My Home. Gore Vidal's new book is Imperial America, Reflections on the United States of Amnesia, published by Nation Books. Another recent book is Inventing a Nation, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, published by Yale University Press. Remember, you can email Gore Vidal at gorevidal, G-O-R-V-I-D-A-L, at WBAI.org, or write him, care of WBAI, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. For WBAI, I'm the producer of this program, Janet Coleman. Thanks.
And you're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
Lost my job, joined the army to get an education, and I most surely did. Wanted to have some kind of steady job, lead a decent life, support me and my wife and kid. First I was based in Texas, then it was off to Germany, then they sent us to Iraq. So many ruined buildings, so many burned up bodies, twisted railroad track. We were sent off to Fallujah, told to keep to peace amidst such hunger and despair. I was only 21, didn't have a clue what I was doing there. Now they say the war is over and I'm back at home, here in the land of the free. And you're looking at the face of victory, you're looking at the face of victory. Patrolling through Fallujah, driving on the rubble, shattered pavement and shattered glass. They sent us on a search for weapons. We looked in every basement, never found a single barrel of gas. And when we saw the cities looted, as we watched the oil pipelines, it all began to seem so clear. We were fighting for Exxon, dying for Chevron, that's what we were doing here. They told us we'd be welcomed as troops of liberation. Once again they lied. We got shot at every day. Everywhere we went, a bunch of my buddies died. A rocket launcher hit my tank, started up a fire, blew my legs right off of me. Now you're looking at the face of victory. You're looking at the face of victory. I went back to Michigan, they put some plastic on my stumps and sent me on my way. Now I roll on down the city streets, looking at the people as they turn their eyes away. Down at the burn, they were talking about the government, how it's all a ruse. And I get a little madder every time I see the president smirking on the evening news. I think of how they duped me and so many more good people, and I think of the price we paid. The rich keep getting richer, and the bastards are already scheming about the next nation they want us to invade. Yeah, I keep on thinking about this situation. I think of Oklahoma City, and you're looking at the face of victory. You're looking at the face of victory. You're looking at the face of victory.